It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Last month, the Grammy Award-winning and Oscar-nominated jazz composer Terrence Blanchard was in Central Illinois at the U of I's Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. He was there to perform excerpts from his opera, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, based on the memoir of that name by New York Times columnist Charles M. Blow. It's about the mistreatment Blow experienced as a child and the hardships he had to overcome in life. Blanchard is also known for composing movie scores, including Malcolm X and Love and Basketball. Before his performance at Krannert Center, he talked with my Illinois public media colleague, David Pierce.
Tell me, Terrence, how is this story common to Black Americans?
Very common. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to do it. Growing up in my neighborhood, I wasn't sexually abused the way he was, but I know what isolation feels like because I was the guy wearing glasses, carrying a horn case, walking to the bus stop every weekend to go for my lessons, which wasn't the most popular thing to do in my neighborhood at the time. And I was always seeming to be a little different from the other kids because I was shy, I was quiet. The main reason why I wanted to do it with Charles is that Charles is a living example of how to overcome all of that stuff. You know, to see the level of success that he achieved in his life, man, I mean, it's incredible. And the beautiful thing about it, when we premiered it in St. Louis, I walked over to him afterwards. I said, "We okay?" You know, and he said, "Yeah, it's good for me to see this," because he said, "Made me realize I'm not that person anymore," which was powerful.
Destiny is a common theme in this story as well. Tell me, what is it about destiny that directs Charles's path and allows people to make sound decisions?
Well, the thing about it, you know, we had this character, Destiny, in the opera. And for me, destiny is that thing that's bigger than us as individuals. Nothing can stop you. It's like your purpose in life. And some of us manage to recognize that. Some of us don't. The beautiful thing about what happened to Charles is that his isolation created this arena for him to reflect on his own life and what it is that he wanted to do. So when he started to make the connection into journalism, sky was the limit for this guy. And it still is. I mean, he's still doing a lot of great stuff.
You intertwine jazz, R&B, and gospel into this opera. Not only do you have three genres of music, but now you are transitioning that into a performance. What was that like?
It was a blessing because it's more about trying to just put our culture on the stage and let people get a glimpse of what it is that we experience going on. It was a blessing because it's more about trying to just put our culture on the stage and let people get a glimpse of what it is that we experienced growing up. It was so fascinating, man, you know, because even though it's Charles's story, I'm reliving my life through some of these scenes. A lot of people who came to the performances said the exact same thing. And I think that's the thing that resonated for a lot of people, because a lot of times when you talk about opera, a lot of times for most people, you're dealing with topics that doesn't resonate in their life because the operas are historic. They were created in another period of our history. When we did Champion, my boxing opera in New Orleans, there was an older brother that came up to me and he said, "Hey man, if this is opera, I'll come." And that's what we started to see. We sold out the shows.
This project led to you being the first ever African-American composer, right? To grace New York's Metropolitan Opera House in its nearly 140-year existence.
Yeah.
this being an African-American story told on such a big stage, how would you say this breaks barriers?
Oh, it broke a lot of barriers, you know, because what upset me about that moniker is that I always have to tell people I was the first, but I wasn't the first qualified. There were composers that were very qualified well before me. Wayne Grant Still is one of the ones that I cite. I actually saw a ledger of rejected projects and his name was in there three times. And some of the comments that was made about his music was incredible. Given the fact that I just saw one of the performances of his opera in St. Louis and thought it was amazing. Didn't know it was his opera. And I'm sitting going, man, what is this? This is beautiful. This is, and it was an opera written, it's called Highway One, written in the 30s. That's how forward thinking this guy was. It's powerful and it broke barriers because it opened a door for a lot of people. It opened the doors for the Met, for a new audience to come into the Met. For the new audience that came in, they got a chance to experience opera in their own, on their own terms because it was dealing with their culture. It allowed them to buy tickets to other operas. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Let me reintroduce our conversation. We're listening to an interview my Illinois Public Media colleague David Pierce recorded with the jazz trumpeter and composer Terrence Blanchard. A version of this conversation first aired on the IPM show Dialogue. We'll have more after a break. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to our interview with the composer and jazz trumpeter Terrence Blanchard. Last month, before a performance at the Krannert Center in Urbana, he spoke with my Illinois Public Media colleague, David Pierce.
You've done film scores for movies like George Lucas's Red Tail, Cassie Lemon's Harriet, and Spike Lee's Malcolm X. What's it like bringing the sound to a film?
It's really rewarding. You know, when we worked on The Woman King, I was privileged to work on that. Just like I did with Malcolm X and Four Little Girls and so many other projects that I've done in my career, because those are the stories of our culture and our history. To be able to put it on par with anything in our medium is important to me. I don't want, when you see our stories, to feel like they can't compete. in any genre or any market because they can. The Woman King felt like the culmination of a lot of my experiences brought to bear. And when I brought Diane Reeves in to sing on it, she said the exact same thing. To feel a blessing, to have the opportunity, but with that opportunity comes a larger amount of responsibility. It just makes you work hard to make sure that things are right. Because with all of these films that I've done with so many other people, I am proud to say that I'm excited for my grandchildren to be able to sit down and watch these films and learn more about their culture.
When that Pharaoh chariot comes, I'm gonna leave you. I'm bound for the promised land. I'm gonna leave you. I'm sorry, I'm gonna leave you.
What is it about music that draws emotion within the films?
Yeah, because the music is that intangible thing. It's that sound. It goes beyond language.
I'll meet you in morning. I'm bound for the promised land.
You know, you ever been hurt to the point where you can't even put it into words? Or excited to the point where you can't even put it into words?
I'm sorry, I'm gonna leave you. Farewell, oh farewell. But I'll meet you in
music is that thing that bridges the gap between emotions and expression. And when done right, man, it can really, really powerfully tell a story with great storytellers. But the people that I've worked with, they'll send me the project and I always have like a oh my God kind of moment. So I always love that feeling of being terrified because the project is so good that it makes me really step up to the plate. You're looking at this project, you're looking at the actors, you're thinking about they shot this for 3 or 4 months. Everybody's putting their heart, sweat, and tears into this thing, and that's in your hands. A good friend of mine, man, Wynn Thomas, who's a set designer, he told me something that really calmed me down. He said, we all want to do 150% on these projects. He said, but the best thing for us to do is to just do your job. And when he said that, I went, okay, cool. Then you just go back and regroup.
You've used your musical abilities to give voice to societal issues and racial injustice. Mm-hmm. And you've even been quoted saying, like anybody else, I would like to play feel-good party music.
Yeah.
But sometimes my music is about the reality of where we are.
Yeah.
Where are we today?
Woo! Well, you know, it's kind of like an interesting dilemma where we are in the country, in the world, basically.
Yeah.
It seems as though we're at a point in time, there's a tipping point that some people don't want to really admit to.
Yeah.
You know, we're at a point where it's inevitable for us to become like one really homogenous race. It's going to evolve over the course of time, obviously. And some people are afraid of that and don't want to accept that. So they're fighting really hard to maintain what they perceive to be their culture. It's putting us, people of color, in a precarious situation because we're not the lawmakers in big numbers. We're not the ones who write the checks. We've made inroads in all of those areas, don't get me wrong, because they're very powerful people of color in all aspects of American life.
Correct.
But when you see what's happening in Washington, it's very apparent that there's an effort to stifle the growth of other ethnic cultures in this country.
Yeah.
And that's virtually impossible. You could do all of these things that you're doing right now, the budget cuts and all of this other stuff, but in the end, you're gonna wind up hurting your own people more so than anything else. And this is where the arts really comes into play with this. You know, we've been through this before as people of color. There are other people in this country that haven't been through this. So they don't know how to respond to this, right?
Yeah.
But people of color have been through this before, mm-hmm. right? And we know that we just need to hunker down and support our community, support each other, but also make sure that we're trying to uplift everybody, right? And that we try to educate and move forward because that will come to pass eventually. It's already happening. It's just that this is just a bump in the road.
You are from the birthplace of jazz,
yes,
that
sir.
Being New Orleans.
Yes.
How would you say being in the heart of jazz music developed your musical abilities?
New Orleans has had a huge impact on my outlook as a musician because the foundation of a lot of what it is that we play in American music comes from the blues, comes from jazz. Hearing all of that, along with R&B, gospel, and all that other stuff in New Orleans growing up, really gave me a strong musical foundation. That's one of the things when we were talking earlier during the masterclass about how I'm able to cross genres, because that's all I know growing up. It's always interesting to me, you know, the whole notion of what it means to be African-American in this country. It's a broad, broad, broad brush that we can paint our culture with. We come in every walk of life, dude. Experiencing that in New Orleans gave me that foundation, like I was saying, to experience music on its own terms, not come to it with an attitude, you know what I mean, or none of that stuff. I look at it and I go, that's God's creation, right? And there's meaning in everything that's happening in all of those musics. It constantly keeps me humble and keeps me aware.
Now at center field, New Orleans own Terrence Blanchard.
You've just performed at the 2025 Super Bowl. This highlighting Black culture in America, you know, in the heart of jazz.
Yes.
What would you say it did for Black culture?
It was an amazing thing because, you know, our president was there at the game. And I kept wondering, is this resonating with anybody? You know what I mean? Because we had the pre-show where you had nothing but New Orleans culture, which is the thing that I was a part of. And then you had that show that Kendrick did on, which was amazing. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, is anybody sitting here really watching this and getting it? The mere fact that there were so many people who had to explain Kendrick's show. Right. I mean, because it was powerful. It was really powerful. And, you know, the thing that I loved about it was there was no mishaps. There was no negative thing that could become this gotcha moment, you know, later on. It was just like a really great performance that had a message.
Do you think that we're reaching a point in American history where Black people's contribution, culture, and impact are becoming undeniable?
I hope. I really hope, man. I really hope, because like that movie, Hidden Figures, right? That's powerful.
Yeah.
To think that we had African-American females that contributed so much to our defense system and just everything that they were doing. And it's all over so many different genres. The Super Soaker, I know it's kind of silly, but to think that African-American had something to do with the development of that.
Elevator.
I mean, it's like—
Air conditioner.
Come on.
Streetlights.
Right, exactly. But the wild part about it is we have to really deal with our educational system. And I'm talking about from the lower levels of education, because there's so many people who think that African-Americans haven't contributed anything to this culture. And that is just simply not true.
Yeah.
That's simply not true. I mean, you know, it's a fascinating thing when you look at the contributions that we've made to the world, not just the U.S., but to the world, have been enormous. You know, I was hoping with the internet that would really become come about, but as we see with anything, anybody with nefarious intentions can steal attention and try to create their own narratives.
Yeah.
You have to keep doing stuff like this, like you're doing,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And everybody has to keep reporting and keep their stories out. Mm-hmm. And we have to celebrate those,
yeah.
You know, so our young people can learn about them as well.
Who would you say has had an impact on your career?
Oh man, so many people. Because you go to my heroes first, the Miles Davis, Clifford Brown, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, Art Blakey, the jazz muscle, just that thing. Then it goes to the younger musicians that I play with, and even my family, you know, my kids. I look at them, man, and I feel very blessed to have four very productive, very different kids and two grandkids, right? And I just watch them and I get inspired by what it is that they do and the type of people that they are. Because I'm in this business of entertainment, right?
Yeah.
That's a business that at some point is of service. And I look at my kids, and inadvertently, they are all about that. So I find inspiration now from a lot of different things, man. It's been a beautiful experience because I try to channel that into what it is that I do artistically. You know, not specifically, but the energy of that, the purpose behind that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Why would you say service is important? Like doing whatever it is that you are doing within your position, but doing it with the intent of service.
Well, service is really important because none of us know it all. Everybody has an area of expertise. In order to combat the stuff that we were just talking about earlier, the things that we're confronting as a community, we all have to stick together and be of service and really give my experiences to help people grow musically. That's my area of expertise. And in doing so, hopefully I can help some young musicians create music that help people reflect, help them heal, make them think about things differently. Then I have other friends of mine who are in other areas of life. I have friends of mine that are federal judges, friends of mine that are accountants, friends of mine that are news reporters. And they all feel a need to help younger people because we're really trying to grow this thing, you know, in a way that really makes us a very, very vibrant and strong community.
Terrence Blanchard in conversation with my Illinois Public Media colleague David Pierce. This interview was produced by Kimberly Schofield and first aired on the IPM program Dialogue. That is all the time we have for today and this week. Next week, the leaders of NPR and PBS are scheduled to testify before the United States House of Representatives Subcommittee on DOGE. It's chaired by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. The hearing is titled Anti-American Airwaves, Holding the Heads of NPR and PBS Accountable. This is part of a coordinated effort by the Trump administration to investigate public broadcasting in America. There are parallel efforts, including one targeting our sister station, WBEZ, in Chicago. All this was laid out in Project 2025. We had a thorough conversation anticipating it on the show back in January, and we're planning to re-air that on Monday. We'd love to hear what you think about what we've been talking about today or any show in the past. Let us know by emailing talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. You can find that address and every other way to contact us on our website, which is 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past programs there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcasts, or look us up on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.